Thank you for listening to the Faith Radio Mornings podcast. Enjoy the conversation.
Start your day connecting faith to life with Faith Radio Mornings.
Let it rise.
Good morning. It's 4 minutes after the hour. I hope your Wednesday is starting off well. This is Bill Arnold. People that don't know me, I wish they did. And people that do not know me, well, they wish they didn't know me. I don't know. It's kind of a zero-sum game. All right, let's start with God's Word. You know, I looked up a verse today in several different versions, and here they are. The verse is Psalm 118, semicolon, 24. Easy to remember. This is the day the Lord has made. Let us rejoice and be glad in it. Here's another version. This is the day the Lord has made. We will rejoice and be glad in it. And another translation, this is the day the Lord has made. Let's rejoice and be glad today. And here's another one. This is the day the Lord has made. Email Faith Radio and tell them how much you like the new host guy. Wait, I didn't get that right. Anyway, we've got a great show today. We've got Wes Furlong coming up. He's going to be talking this morning about smart compassion, how to stop doing outreach and start making change. That's going to be interesting. Looking forward to that. Lots of things happening in the news. I found this very compelling as a guy. There was a restaurant in Australia that had a 5-foot lizard come into the restaurant. And people that were eating there started screaming. Go figure. A female waitress dragged it out by the tail, I think because all the male waitstaff were standing on the tables. And the restaurant then, of course, had to put up a sign that said, employees must wash hands after dragging lizards out of restaurants. I tell you, the regulations make people crazy. Seems like common sense to me, doesn't it? Dragging a 5-foot lizard out of the restaurant. That's crazy. All right. Also today, we're going to have Ken Kaiser. He's the chair of communications here at Northwestern College. We're going to talk about interesting news of the day and what's going on in his head. And it's always very busy in his head. So we're looking forward to that. We're going to talk to him about liberal sports writers and how interesting that the people that cover sports are more and more liberal and the attitude they have about that. So we're also going to talk to David Bailey in the second hour, and he helps churches become more culturally informed, talking about the vision for racial and ethnic harmony in the church. And, of course, later on, second hour, Dr. Jerry Root, he's the professor of evangelism at Wheaton, and he's going to talk about when evangelism really isn't that hard and equipping believers to share their faith. So you're not going to want to miss any of this. This is a big morning. So when we come back, we're going to take a little break. We are going to talk about smart compassion, and that calls Christians to strategic, prayerful, and biblically based approaches to compassion. I think a lot of us can be kind of compassion fatigued. We're all trying so hard to meet all the needs of everybody, and maybe we're burning out. So Wes will probably give us some great advice as to how to do it smarter. So I'm all for that. It is 7 minutes after the hour. Good morning. Happy Wednesday. Glad you're with us. This is Faith Radio Mornings. Bill Arnold here. We'll be back in a minute. Good morning, everybody. 8 minutes after the hour. You're just getting started. Well, good luck today. We all need it, don't we? But start with prayer. Remember, this is the day the Lord has made. Let's rejoice and be glad in it. And let's work smart. Let's not work stupid. So here to help us understand how to have smart compassion is Wes Furlong. He's the founder and director of City of Refuge, a network for community transformation, and the director of church development for Ivana. And that is an evangelical Anabaptist network of churches across North America. He holds a master's degree in theology from Emory and is working toward a doctoral. So he's paying attention in life. Wes, welcome to the big show.
Good to be with you, Bill.
Thanks.
Good morning.
Thanks. Let's talk about the idea of smart compassion. Where did that originate from? And really, what's the difference between doing outreach and then smart compassion?
Well, it started in our work at a church I pastored in Florida for 11 years, and our principle as a church largely was just to to do more things. More people doing more things was a good thing. And we didn't really look at what the outcomes were of what we were doing. And we just kind of stumbled into some of these big questions of, well, how do we know what really works? What should we be measuring? And where should we be even putting our resources, time and money? So that was where it really got started, was just some personal engagement in Cape Coral, Florida.
Mm-hmm. Now, you write in your book, and the book is called Smart Compassion, that one of the greatest barriers hindering churches from making significant impact in their community is a lack of knowledge. So why knowledge?
Mm-hmm. So one of the things we actually experienced was we were doing a lot of things, running food pantries and engaging in a lot of different programs, but we found out that there were children sleeping in government offices because there weren't enough foster homes. And no one had any idea.
Mm-hmm.
And so we started actually asking questions about, how are things in our community in areas like child welfare, health, rather than just being presumptuous about assuming we knew what the needs and opportunities really were. And as we traveled around other churches and talked to people, we would share some of this data. And it was almost always the same response. We had no idea. We didn't know. And as people learned, it really helped engage in ways where, maybe just doing like kind of the equivalent of like a drive-by guilting might not do.
So when you say that kids were living in government buildings, I don't even know what that means. Just as an example, I'm curious.
Our children were pulled out of their homes by a child protective investigator and placed in foster care.
Ah.
As they're waiting for placement in a foster home, they would be brought to the offices. But a lot of times, as the people are making the calls, there weren't enough foster homes to place them. And so they would spend the night there until they could find the place the next day or so. And there was a huge shortage of foster homes in our area. And there were, as we drew it on a map, there were probably a couple dozen churches within a five-mile radius of that building. And nobody had any idea.
Wow. Okay. So this begs the next question, which is, let's talk about maybe a great story, an inspiring example of how you take some of this knowledge and put it together with what you call smart compassion.
Yeah, I do this quite a bit in the book. I tell a lot of stories of people who, against a lot of odds and without a lot of resources, they just draw a circle around an area and they start to pray, God, your kingdom here. And they start to find what works and start to put people together. And it's amazing what can happen over time. And so I tell the story of a woman in Nashville, Tennessee, where we went to college, and she just saw a couple of women who were prostitutes, and she just brought them into her home. And that's one of the big principles I talk about in the book, is radical hospitality and reclaiming the biblical and historical foundations of what real hospitality is. And that ministry has grown to now it's across the United States, and there's business aspects to it, and it's highly strategic. But it's also super relational.
Mm-hmm. Was that woman able to help these prostitutes get out of prostitution and perhaps into a more productive life or their own apartment? Or?
Oh, yeah. Yes. So there's now the program is about 18 months. And so it's a highly intensive residential program where they have job training and counseling and medical services. And there's a whole new business that's merged out of this. These women, they come off the street. They don't just come off the streets. They move into productive, fruitful living.
Mm-hmm. Wes, I'm going to ask you to just be real careful to keep your mouth close to your phone because it's getting a little fuzzy at times. But I want to talk about the great challenge that we have when it comes to trying to make changes, because we do want to make changes in the community versus just doing what we call outreach. How do we separate those two and go, okay, I want to do outreach, but what I really want to do is make some cool changes?
One of the first things we've got to do is think about place-based ministry and draw an area, a circle, or whatever it is around an area, and look at the relationship between all of the different parts. And one of the first things I think we can start to reclaim is just the idea of loving our neighbors. How do we start with just those right around us? To make sure we know what the needs are, to start finding ways that make sense to practice hospitality, to make relational connections where if there's something that's needed, like we really can help. And then I think the third part is to find where some of our greatest gifts best intersect with our community needs. Mm-hmm. And that's the third part I talk about in the book is where has God given us unique gifting, opportunities, experiences that can best be leveraged for what the needs in our area are.
Yeah. Couldn't we just begin and end right there, just loving our neighbor? Wouldn't that solve all the problems?
That is definitely a place to start, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. All right, we're going to take a break when we come back. Lots more with Wes Furlong. You're listening to Faith Radio Mornings. Bill Arnold here. I'll take a short break and be right back. After the hour, Bill Arnold here. We're talking to Wes Furlong, and he is the founder and director of City of Refuge, a network for community transformation. And he's written a book called Smart Compassion. And we all have compassion at times, and some more than others. So I think it's encouraging to always encourage us to have more compassion. But we want to do it in a smart way so we don't burn out and that we do the most and best work. Now, Wes, I have a question because we love big data. We're always looking at trends and big data, and it's everywhere. And I know you advocate for that. You think it's wise to take the data and the measurements when you're engaging with the community. So talk a little bit about that, because to me, that is a little bit over my head. And I think he's maybe slipped away. All right, Wes, I don't think you have left us on purpose. Maybe you have. Maybe he thought, enough of that guy. Enough. Anyway, we were talking to Wes Furlong, and this book is so interesting because as Christians, we try to do as much outreach as we can. But really, the million-dollar question that Wes wants to address with us, if we get him back on the line. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, awesome. You went away for a while, but that's all right. I was talking about the whole idea of big data and the way that you use big data and measurements for community engagement. I don't know if I know what that means, so help me out with that one.
When it comes to really defining a geography and knowing it well, so people that want to look at their area and say, where do we best help? Where should we get involved? The accessibility of data is sometimes really surprising what you can figure out when it comes to looking both at a geography and then looking at areas like child welfare, health, education, housing. The access to data is, when we first started using it and started learning, how do we do mapping? How do we do good assessments? We were really surprised what's available just in terms of accessible local, state, and federal data.
Do you think that when you're doing outreach, that is there a time that you look at outreach work and go, okay, this is actually doing more harm than good? I mean, can we do compassion poorly?
Yeah, I think one of the first things to look at is the posture of relationships. So are we engaging in disempowering relationships with people where it's fostering dependency? And what we found, our experience, was that some of our greatest instincts are the things that actually are the things that are unfortunately most disempowering. Because we like to give, and sometimes we'll give things that will be more transactional in nature rather than something that can be sustaining or relational. And those aren't the things that really long-term make the biggest difference. Now, it may be good just to, you know, like the equivalent of like a triage, but it's better to move into relational forms of engagement that empower people rather than just keep this cycle of giver and receiver.
Mm-hmm.
And that's even one of the rules, I think, of data is you can answer questions that in the past we haven't been able to answer.
Okay.
So when it comes to how do we know what the real needs are, we can use data to really help zero in on where we should really be getting involved.
Mm-hmm. What about short-term missions trips and little things where you're reaching out to the community and, you know, the intention is really good, but this is something I should sign up for, and I'll be able to get, you know, a selfie with some people that are in need, and I can post it on my Facebook page, and, wow, look, I've done some good. What about when What about when this goes, you know, when your intentions are good, but you're actually being destructive to the cause?
Yeah, short-term mission trips are always a good conversation point on the application of these kinds of principles. I think it just depends. There's always a good thing when it comes to exposure for people to see and find ways to get involved. The negatives might be it might take people who are on the field away from their work, their primary work. There's definitely things that it could do that could be negative. I think overall, short-term mission trips, if they're vision trips and it's you're doing some training maybe or bringing a unique skill in and there's an educational component, it can be helpful. But yeah, I think a lot of times the way that we construe them and develop them, it's not maybe as fruitful as we might hope.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Wes, can you talk a little bit about radical hospitality? Maybe elaborate on that a little bit because, you know, what is it? What does it look like? And I'm certainly not doing it, so tell me how might you encourage me?
Well, I'll tell you a story. When we started with foster care and we had figured out that there was a great need for foster parents, we started a lot of programs for foster kids, all kinds of programs from supporting foster parents. We basically did everything we can do without becoming foster parents. And what we figured out was as we actually started to become licensed foster parents and invite kids into our home, it changed everything. I mean, it didn't just change our engagement with the foster care system and the families. It actually changed us too. And I had always had this firewall between our house and out there. And for me, ministry was what happened out there, but in my house, that was our safe place and peace. And that experience fostering, I think, really helped open our eyes to the importance of actually drawing into ourselves the other and bringing neighbors and people into our house and using our house and our family, our relationships, as a conduit of healing for other people.
All right. Now, you obviously probably don't recommend jumping in blindly to some of these significant commitments like foster parenting and foster care. So your approach, you'd probably recommend everyone to take that approach, huh?
Well, actually, I talk quite a bit about this in the book. How do you know what to say yes and no to? And we've seen some people who, I remember a young couple just married, had a little baby, and they really felt pulled to foster a sibling group of seven. I mean, it would have been a terrible, probably, situation. I mean, they had no experience, and it would have been really probably overwhelming. But they wanted to help. And eventually they didn't do it, and the situation turned out a lot better. But in the book, I kind of walk through how do you answer those kinds of big questions. What do you say yes and no to?
Mm-hmm.
And there's a real difference between stretching ourselves, growing even slowly into more intentional ways of cultivating hospitality versus just jumping in blindly to something that you may not be ready for or your family system may not be able to sustain.
Mm-hmm. So it's important to understand what the healthy boundaries are and then be from there willing to take the big risk to figure out ways to have radical hospitality in your life.
Yeah, they really do have to work together. Love the boundaries. We stretch, but we also pay attention to what's the full impact of our yes and no's.
Yeah, so you're getting better and better at it as you get older, aren't you? This radical hospitality and having smart compassion. I love it.
Yeah, the relational parts change things. When you see people who will open up their homes in ways that make sense and leverage their strengths in the community, and make sure that they know what's going on, what's needed, what works.
Mm-hmm.
It does. It makes all the difference in the world.
Yeah, I'd like to have people in my house, but that means I'd have to clean it, so not interested. Wes, thanks so much for being a guest on the show. Thanks for getting up early and talking about smart compassion. We all need a little encouragement in that department, so I appreciate you being on the show. It's 26
thanks,
minutes
Bill.
After the hour. Welcome to Faith Radio Mornings. Bill Arnold here. I'll take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to have some news, and then Kent Kaiser is going to show up. That's what I've been told. I can't wait to see if that's true. Be back in a minute. 29 minutes after the hour. Good morning, everybody. Bill Arnold here. We're going to take a little news break, and then when we come back, we have so much programming today you're going to love. So stick around. We'll be back in a minute. Life is uncertain, yet we don't have to fear the future. Bill English points to the biblical story of Joseph and reminds us to hang on to hope in the midst of uncertainty.
The thing that God did for Joseph, the favor that he did for him that Joseph did not recognize at the time, was that when Joseph was sold into slavery, God took Joseph to a point of no return. Joseph could not rely on any of the resources he had relied on up to that point. They were all taken away from him. He was put in an entirely brand new situation, and he was never going to be able to go back to those resources. His dad, presumably his brothers, and all that he knew. So everything that he was about, everything that he had depended on, was in a matter of a few hours just swiftly taken away from him, and he was put in a point of no return. God does that sometimes with us. He just comes along and says, you are no longer going to do this, or I'm going to take away this resource. Perhaps a line of credit gets called by the bank. The bank calls up and says, you know, we're not going to renew this. And you are suddenly, within just a matter of minutes or an hour, you are in a very different place than you were before that. These things can happen in business. They can happen in life. You can be fine one day and be in a car accident and your whole life has changed. It is not unusual for God to do things like this in our lives in order to get our attention and to refocus our lives back on that which is most important, which is our love for Him and our holiness before Him.
That is Bill English, consultant and founder of BibleAndBusiness.com, a real friend here at Faith Radio. If you want to hear the full interview with Bill English, go to MyFaithRadio.com.
As Christians, how are we perceived by our culture? For or against? This is Jim Garlow. Most often, Christians are perceived as being against something, but let's not let the secularists label us. Critics of Christians say we're anti-abortion. No, we're pro-life. They say we're anti-gay marriage. No, we're for traditional, biblical, historic, natural, orthodox marriage. In the Proposition 8 battle in California, clear back in 2008, against same-sex marriage, they said we were against them. No, Proposition 8 was just 14 words, simply affirming the reality of biblical marriage between a man and a woman. There are some legitimate things we have to be against. In fact, some of the Ten Commandments say, thou shalt not, 8 to be exact. So don't be intimidated by critics who say, oh, you're always against stuff. Yeah, we're against some things, but let's be known by what we're for. There's more at jimgarlow.com.
Minutes after the hour. Good morning, Bill Arnold here. I'm going to start talking to Ken Kaiser. He's the chair of communications here at the University of Northwestern, and he's a regular on Wednesday morning. And Kent, did you know that UConn is looking for their 102nd straight win tonight? The triple-digit win streak for UConn women's basketball is getting put to the test. They are facing Temple, and they're going to be looking for their number 102 in a row. How cool is that?
Definitely a powerhouse.
Yeah, powerhouse for sure. Now, speaking of sports, and what a nice segue there, Bill, let's talk about what's going on with the people that report on sports, kind of liberal sports writers.
Yeah,
I know it's kind of a different topic from what we're usually used to. But I know you're a big sports fan, and I think it taps into some of your research.
It's true. Yes, sports reporting has been, and sports commentary has really been political in the last few years, and it's just ramped up, especially now since this past election. But it's been going on for a few years, where it seems like the sports commentators really have this political agenda. And for me, it's interesting because all of my research, you know, professors, we teach, and then on the side, we often have some kind of research that we do, and mine has always been in sport communication.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is a particular interest to me, how political these folks have become. In fact, my whole dissertation was on a big political issue, which was Title IX, and people might know that issue, that Title IX is the law that requires equality for men and women in sports, and it's been most, or in all aspects of education, where there's federal funding involved, and basically that means every school in the country, because even at college, at the college level, students bring federal financial aid with them. So where that law, Title IX, has been most controversial recently has been with sports, and you know, people have probably heard about the equality of men and women in sports, and schools needing to offer equality in sports teams and time on the field and time in the practice facilities and so on. And so that political issue has been around for a long time, but now it seems like there are many more political issues that are being brought up in sports, and kind of gratuitously. It's almost as though the sports reporters and sports commentators have just joined the rest of the liberal media and really going out of their way to sort of push a liberal agenda in their sports writing. And just to give some examples, because people might be thinking, well, how could sports possibly be political? Well, it's everything from lately on the issue of immigration and sports reporters and commentators talking about, you know, of course, all the players, especially in baseball, who are from other countries and really kind of pushing up against Trump's agenda for secure borders. It's also on issues like sports mascots. And, you know, it's an interesting issue in and of itself. You know, we've gotten to the point where even if a mascot is portrayed in a really noble and uplifting sort of a way, mm-hmm. if it's a non-white character being portrayed, then somehow it's bad just by virtue of not being white. And it's going to be interesting, I think, in like 50 years from now, if we're, you know, saying that we should have diversity in sports and all of the human characters that are sports mascots are white.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it's counterintuitive or something, I think, to say that only we should only revere white players or white mascots, or that we should only cheer with white mascots. It's a very strange thing that's happening there. But there are many other political issues, and it seems as though the sports commentators are often just sort of speaking at their audience or even at a caricature of their audience. It seems that there's almost disdain these days between the sports commentators and the people who should be their audience.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think if you look at the average people who are going to any sporting event, both sort of the men and women, I think they probably come from a more conservative bent. And I mean, I just give an example. It's kind of funny. Over just before the election, I happened to have been at a conference in Florida, and for my free time, I went to a hockey game in Florida. Yeah, it was great.
I liked it for some reason.
But at one point, there was like some pictures of some news. There was like a picture of a quiz that comes up on the Jumbotron, and you're supposed to match the first lady with the president that she goes with. And
mm-hmm.
you know, and so they went through a bunch of them, the Bushes and the Reagans, and then up came Hillary Clinton. And this is, again, before the election, huge boos from the audience. You know, it's like, so you got a kind of a sense of where this audience was coming from politically.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's pretty normal for a sports audience to be a little bit more on the conservative side of things. And yet these sports commentators are often coming from a completely different worldview and trying to sort of force these political issues down their throats now.
Mm-hmm.
Very strange.
Yeah, there was a sports writer that admitted in an article I read yesterday that he said, and I can't recall his name right now, but he said, most writers do not write for the common ordinary fan.
Right.
So your point is well taken. They are pushing some agenda of some kind.
Yeah, and it's you have to wonder who they're writing for, because we know that there are people who purchase the newspaper. I mean, to the extent that anybody purchases the actual hard copy of the newspaper anymore, but there are people who read the newspaper, whether it's hard copy or online, specifically for the sports.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's very strange that they seem to be trying to push this agenda. It seems that at some point they're just going to sort of cut off their audience altogether.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, at some point people become fed up with this.
Right. Now, are sports writers upset that sports are politically incorrect? Because really only the best people get the job.
Well, you know, see, this is the thing. They don't necessarily bring that up, but they do seem to have disdain for a lot of the characteristics that we would say are part of being an elite athlete.
Mm-hmm.
You see many of the elite athletes on television who are Christian
mm-hmm.
and who are openly Christian, and they put verses on their faces and on mm-hmm. their jerseys and everything else, And some of these reporters are, you know, will confront that. In fact, I've heard reporters for television say that sometimes they explicitly avoid interviewing specific athletes because they know that they're not going to be able to get what they would call a clean clip without a verse or without some reference to God in it.
Interesting.
Because some athletes are really adept at putting God into every sentence, and it's great.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, then that leads to them being avoided by sports reporters. And I've heard sports reporters say that very explicitly.
Yeah. Well, didn't Curt Schilling, the former pitcher, just get buried by suggesting that athletes by nature are really hardworking individuals that know the value of hard work?
Well, this
and
is
largely
the thing.
Most of them are conservative.
Like,
I'm talking right now.
Yeah, exactly. Look at somebody like Cal Ripken. I mean, like, this isn't, you know what I mean? You look at somebody like him. And you have to say, yeah, he got to where he is because he works hard. I mean, you know, he shows up.
Yeah, exactly. You know? Exactly.
Yeah.
All right. This is an interesting topic. I love it. I think it's worth returning to. We're going to take a little break when we come back. Lots more with Dr. Kent Kaiser, Bill Arnold here. We're having fun this morning. Join us. Stay with us. Tell your friends about us. Be back in a minute. Forty-seven minutes after the hour. Hope your day is going well. You know, the word of the day is mayhap. I saw that on my app on my phone. The word is mayhap on my app. And that means possibly, but not certainly, which is really the possible outcome of this interview right now with Dr. Kent Kaiser. We're talking about liberal sports writers and how they report, not necessarily to the common fan, but they're pushing their agenda. I think it was maybe the Olympics or something. I can't remember. It was some significant sports event, and Bob Costas got on, and he started talking about gun control. I thought, where'd that come from?
Right.
Do you remember that?
I do.
Yeah.
I mean, it was, and he got a lot of backlash for it, but I mean, he stood his ground and he's still working.
Mm-hmm.
So,
you mean Bob Costas is still working in liberal media today?
Well, yeah, you know.
Really? I'm so confused.
So, yeah, no, it's been very interesting to see how many different issues have been brought up in the context of sports commentaries that you wonder why is that issue in there in the first place, but it is also interesting to me that these issues you would think would be not ones that would attract an audience.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, people talk about how newspaper readership has gone down and so on. And, I mean, I think this is just all part and parcel of it. I mean, again, there are people who purchase the newspaper specifically
right.
because of the sports section.
Right.
And, I mean, if you start turning those people off, they have so many other places to go now. If you want to just find out the sports results and things like this, I don't understand why the paper exists in terms of providing sports results anymore, because you can get them in real time
anywhere.
Online.
I know.
You know, and so what you're buying the newspaper for nowadays, if you're buying for the sports section, is for the commentary and is for the sort of backstories on players and so on. And so if you have this agenda being forced down your throat, well, then you're just going to, I think, look for another venue. I mean, that's what I do. I mean, I go online and follow specific bloggers or specific reporters who I want to hear from, who I know aren't going to be pushing that kind of an agenda. And I think that's what more and more people have done. I mean, you know, so again, if anybody's looking at why are newspapers going downhill in America, why is there less readership? It's not just the fact that now people have the opportunity to get information online. It's also that they're being pushed away
mm-hmm.
by the very people who should be trying to attract them to the newspaper.
Mm-hmm. They are voting with their feet and walking away from stuff.
Yes.
And then newspapers are acting surprised that their viewership is down, their readership is down. All right, let's continue on this subject of liberal media and some of the things that's going on and how they're losing it over the new president.
Well, it just seems like the media have become unhinged about Trump, and I kind of get it. I understand, you know, they have egg on their face because all election cycle long they were saying that Hillary Clinton was going to win. She was definitely their favorite candidate.
Mm-hmm.
They always covered Trump differently. At first, they tried to sort of ignore him, but then, I mean, he was such a larger-than-life figure that they started covering him, but I think they were covering him a lot then just because they thought, oh, this is spectacle, and this will increase viewership, which it did. Mm-hmm. It did increase viewership and readership. But then I think they still were dismissing him like, oh, he certainly won't get the nomination. Oh, he certainly won't win the election. Well, then he did, and so, again, I think they just really are embarrassed by how poorly they reported on him in the first place, and he's not their candidate. And so now he's the opposition to the media, and I think they view him as very much as being the opposition, and he has said that they're the opposition. So we've got, you know, still people on both sides who recognize who their opponent is in a way in this sort of battle for the heart of the American people and for the minds of the American people. And unfortunately for the media, I think there's a couple things going on. One is Trump has many supporters. And so now you have people who the media are actually sort of attacking by virtue of attacking Trump. And you actually see this. I mean, you know, the media not only attack the president himself, but they attack his supporters.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, you've got that situation going on. The other thing that's going on that's been very interesting to me is this whole business of fake news and sort of this, the president calling out the media for their bad reporting, for their reporting on false stories. And it's interesting because I think that the two sides in this, the president and his supporters are on the one side, and I think the media, liberal media, are on the other. And I think part of it is that they have two different definitions of fake news. You know, I was talking to a friend who teaches journalism at a different school, not at Northwestern, but she was saying that fake news is when a reporter really fabricates a story,
mm-hmm,
or reports on a story that just isn't real. Like there's some story that's reported on where the facts are all wrong and it's just, it didn't even actually happen. But the president and supporters have a different definition of fake news, which I think is more realistic and I think people resonates with people more, actually, is that fake news not only includes made-up stories, but it also includes stories that have falsehoods in them. And it's really interesting if you just look at any newspaper on a daily basis, look for the little tiny correction section. It's always tiny. It's always hidden. And it's always huge. It's always got significant, and huge by the fact that it's got usually significant things that the paper is trying to correct,
mm-hmm,
which it reported on incorrectly in previous days. And that is one of the things that Trump and his supporters are calling fake news. And I would agree that it makes it fake news when there's some falsehood in there. But the media don't consider that to be fake news. The other thing that I think is what Trump and his supporters and I would consider to be fake news, too, is when there's a story that's on some insignificant issue that really just the media just pump it up to a level where, of course, that's agenda setting, where the media are trying to set the agenda for the American people and tell them what we should all be thinking about. And they'll take some little tiny story that really should be not much of anything at all, and they'll just talk about it for days and days and days. And when it really has very little impact in the American people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Trump is calling them out for that. The other thing, the other problem I think right now for the media, because right now Trump has an advantage over the media. If you look at the polls, people, this is funny, people actually trust Trump more than they do the media.
Mm.
And everybody knows that Trump is a fibber and an exaggerator and sort of a little bit of a blowhard and so on. And people love him for it, but here's the thing, and I've been telling a lot of my friends this, and much to their dismay, we do not elect politicians to tell us the truth.
Mm-hmm.
We elect them to get stuff done, and they don't purport to tell us the truth. Is they're campaigning. They don't say, oh, I'm going to, you know, that's my job. On the other hand, the media do. The media have been telling us for decades that they will tell us the truth, that they are the purveyors of truth. Well, now they're being revealed as not the purveyors of truth. And so this is a problem for them.
Mm-hmm.
And so you've got, I think, you know, Trump then therefore has an advantage, and it shows up in the polls. The last poll I said 48% of people trusted Trump, and only 42% of people trusted the media to tell the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And again, we know that Trump is an exaggerator and a fibber and things, but people excuse it because that's not his job
to
tell us the truth. I mean, we wish he would, of course. We wish all politicians would tell us the truth, but if you go back through history, they sure don't.
Mm. Yeah, they don't. So when you read something, Kent, what percentage of the time do you believe what you're reading?
Hardly ever.
Really?
And I mean, I think many people are the same way. You have to like confirm things, you have to really dig to see what's the true story nowadays. It's really quite discouraging. There are a few reporters who I think we can maybe trust, and those are the ones you want to try and follow on Twitter or whatever. But I think with any news story, you kind of have to wonder, okay, what was left out? What's really going on here? And then the other thing is you kind of have to back up and say, like, why is this a story?
Mm-hmm.
Because, again, so many of the little stories that get blown up in the media, when you think about it, they really have very little impact on our daily lives. But, you know, if it's something that can be used to put the president in a negative light, then I think you especially have to be skeptical of why the media are really pushing that particular story.
Mm-hmm. Now that we have the term fake news lodged in our brain, we have that as a filter now with everything we read.
That's right.
And I think...
I think you're right. And I think everybody's like, okay, is this real or is this
right.
not real?
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if I trust anything I read. Even my fortune cookie from last night's dinner. I opened it and it said, you are about to eat a small sugar cookie. And that felt like fake news because I didn't eat it.
Funny.
Yeah, whatever, Kent. Kent, come back next Wednesday.
I will do that.
Time permitting. All right?
Thanks for having me on.
It's 57 minutes after the hour. Bill Arnold here. It's Faith Radio Mornings. We'll take a short break and be back. Oh, I love it that the sun is coming up a little bit sooner and staying lighter later. Lighter later. It's a really great time of the year. And I know there are a lot of people enjoying that milder weather, but I think in the upper Midwest, we're getting hit on the weekend with more of that white stuff. So enjoy today. Take a short break and be right back.
Thank you for listening to this conversation from Faith Radio Mornings. These podcasts are available because of listener support. You can make your gift now at myfaithradio.com. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and growing the impact of Faith Radio Mornings. Also, take a moment to subscribe to this podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player and never miss a show.